Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. It is the 11th of July, 2018. So I'm 6 days early for the lecture commemorating the 100th anniversary of the murder of Tsar Nicholas II and his family. In my opinion, it's the most significant political event of the 20th century. It changed the world, as anything happening in Russia usually does. Tsar Nicholas was the last Roman emperor. He is, as a monarch was always understood to be, the last line of defense against Antichrist. Not an Antichrist, but the Antichrist. And it's no accident that around the time of his being deposed, now he did not resign. That letter that he wrote was a forgery. It wasn't written in his style, it wasn't on official letterhead. It simply was a forgery that was sent out to the army, and it immediately destroyed their morale, and which was the point of it. What a lot of people don't realize is how many bishops in the Orthodox Church and how many generals in the army were sympathetic with the what we now know as a provisional government, liberalism in general, and who wanted to see the monarchy destroyed. It would make sense that the upper classes, of course, always want to see a monarch destroyed, because a strong monarchy keeps them from power. Tsar Martyr Nicholas, who was canonized in the latter part of the 20th century by all factions of the Russian Church, it was canonized on the grounds that he was a martyr for the faith. He was explicitly sacrificed. Now, the minyan is the Jewish term that refers to essentially a quorum. And it's normally 10. So you have Voloshkin, Yurovsky, Dzerzhinsky, of course, Sverdlov, Shronatov, Vaganov, Safran, Voykov, Nikulin, and Medvedev. That was your minyan. It's commonly stated that, in other words, it was explicitly stated that this was a sacrifice. Because on the wall, written in Hebrew, it said, and I quote here, "Here, on orders from unseen forces, the king was sacrificed to destroy the society. All goyim are hereby notified." And on the walls you had pornographic images of the empress with Rasputin and all kinds of, their propaganda over the last few years up to that point. The leader of this sacrificial cult was Yurovsky, who was very much like Trotsky, a Jewish nationalist. And a lot of these men had only a minimal knowledge of what we call Bolshevism today. They were just thugs. In the Jewish mind, Tsar Nicholas was the Goy king, in essence. He was the leader of all Christendom. He was leader of essentially the last Christian empire, and certainly the largest and most powerful. Now, we know about World War I. It was brought about by many factors, and primarily British anger and jealousy over the rising might of Germany. The German navy, around 1910, was equal to the size of the British, and her industrial and financial power were now essentially equal to Great Britain. Russia, too, was a substantial threat because of her massive economic growth, her discovery of oil in Azerbaijan, and her stymieing British growth in Asia. And the imperative from London was to make sure that their two rivals, Russia and Germany, fought against each other. Britain couldn't defeat both of them together, even though Germany and Russia are natural allies. They have a lot in common in terms of the political system, and Tsar Nicholas and Kaiser were first cousins. And of course, they found the weak link in the Balkans. And so World War I began. And in, whether it be Austria, Germany, or Russia, it wasn't the monarchs that were interested in war. It was the elected parliaments that were into war. They were the ones who were screaming for it. The monarchs, Kaiser Wilhelm and Nicholas, were not particularly enthusiastic about it. Kaiser Wilhelm had told Vienna that, well, he told them a few things. First of all, the Serbs had no particular interest in killing Ferdinand. Ferdinand was very pro-Slavic. He would have been a decent successor, actually. Number two, that the demands that Austria made on Serbia were too extreme, but importantly, that they had acceded to them. Serbia couldn't fight another war. They were completely broke. They had just been in three Balkan wars. You know, and I'm including, of course, the wars against the Ottoman Turks throughout the latter part of the 19th century. In other words, they've been almost on a consistent state of war since the first uprising against the Janissaries. They simply couldn't maintain a war footing. So there was no one in Serbia, especially in the military, who wanted any war. They simply couldn't do it. But Britain was encouraging Austria to press its advantage in the Balkans because any collapse of the Turkish Empire meant a victory for Russia. And make no mistake, the British would see tens of millions of Europeans killed in order to secure fairly minor advantages in an obscure part of the world. The most arrogant aspect of British foreign policy here, which is absolutely essential to the murder of Tsar Nicholas, is that after Russia had bled against Germany for what amounted to English interests, neither London or Paris would offer the Tsar safe passage. They rejected all appeals from the Russian government and pro-or anti-Russia, because even Kerensky was not interested in seeing the Tsar murdered. It was only the Germans that sought the Tsar's release. And the ambassador to St. Petersburg was offering large sums of money to ransom the monarch, and monarchist groups and the church itself was raising quite a bit of money to ransom him. But that wasn't, there's no amount of money that could satisfy this, because not only the symbolic and religious elements of the murder of the Tsar, but he was simply too dangerous. Now, I wrote a book called The Third Rome back when I was in my late 20s, and a lot of it, you know, I wince when I read it. What it essentially came down to was it was an outline of what I was going to research for essentially the rest of my career. That's what that book was. It was an outline introducing the world to what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my academic life. And I've stayed to that, but there's a lot of errors in it. It was my first book after my dissertation, and there are certain things that I would retract today, and I've dealt with that in other places. But my position on Tsar Nicholas is, for the most part, has remained unchanged. And the murder of Tsar Nicholas was the end of the old order anywhere and everywhere. This was an obsession of the British, and the British government, or I should say the British banks in London, are the primary fomenters of war, and who wanted nothing more than the Tsar to be murdered and a relatively weak government to take over. that Russia would be divided up into easily manageable sections. However, there was also a faction that wanted a strong centralized Russia to keep Russia in the war against Germany. So it really depended on what faction in Great Britain saw which country as a greater threat. Those who had an interest in the Far East saw Russia as a threat, or in the Balkans. Those closer to home saw Germany as a greater threat. As most of you know, Germany was defeating England on the seas. Her submarine technology had outstripped that of the British, and the British had not developed counterweapons to the submarine, and Britain was essentially surrounded, not being anywhere near self-sufficient in food, importing most of it. She was starving. Her losses were massive. Germany essentially fought the war by itself. And of course, it turns out that Germany was far stronger than even the British had realized. But the damage was done. Both Russia and Germany were crippled. And the tens of millions of bodies was, in the British mind, a small price to pay for the maintenance of the British Empire. But in their ignorance, what they didn't realize was that in overthrowing the old order, it would also mean the death of its own empire. But this is what happens when you think in relatively short periods of time rather than long term. However, the greatest evil in the British mind was Germany and Russia joining together. And they will do anything and say anything at the time to keep that from happening. And the same is going on today. But that's a separate issue. The nearly 40 Austrian divisions were used with a smattering of German troops to keep Russia occupied in the east, while Germany dealt with the French. Now, Austria was a great disappointment, and that was a problem for Germany. The German high command performed very well against France and England, and the French had completely gone into a full-blown Napoleonic retreat. A full corps, so that's several divisions, was sent to the eastern part of Germany to shore up the Austrian weakling that was now weakening and dealing with a Russian thrust into German-held territory led by Tsar Nicholas himself. Tsar Nicholas, seeing the inability of Austria to continue the war and the clear defeat of France, decided to launch an assault against Germany and just distract her from the ultimate victory against Paris. Germany had interested herself in the potential wealth of Croatia and Slovenia. They had both been relatively faithful servants of Vienna. And they didn't seek to influence Vienna in any constructive way, but they understood the situation. Austria was in a full and humiliating retreat against an energetic Russia, and Germany was desperately needed to come to her rescue. The offensive in eastern Germany was called off against the original Russian move, and troops were sent southward to bail out what amounted to the flaccid Austrian state. Beginning in 1915, Austria was in collapse. So the planned German offensive against Paris was called off, as Russia had planned. And Russia was poised to win the war against the Central Powers by completely knocking Vienna out of the war and then marching on to Berlin, as the bulk of German forces were struggling in the trenches of the West. The Germans were also worried about a last-ditch British landing in the Balkans, which would have dealt a major blow to Germany if she had combined with Russia. Germany acted quickly, and hundreds of heavy guns were transferred from the Western Front and used to pound Russian positions, thriving on the corpse of Austria-Hungary. But Russia very quickly regrouped and hit Germany back hard, and von Hindenburg wrote in his memoirs, he said, "Our cavalry is driven back by this counterattacking foe," meaning the Russians. "The road to the east is again open to the Russians. We have arrived too late, and we are utterly exhausted." So it's a myth to say that Russia was on the losing end. But the fact of the matter is, no one could win World War I. The sheer number of bodies, the destruction of these governments, there were no winners other than the British bankers. And even there, their empire was soon going to crumble because the liberalism that they were espousing domestically was soon to take root in the Third World. But evaluated objectively, the military situation in Russia early 1917 was not dire. During 1916, the Russian army and the Austrian and Hungarian fronts went on the offensive and achieved major victories, although not in the German-held sections of the front. The shortage of ammunition was a long thing of the past. The army was supplied better than ever. The morale of the frontline troops was fully satisfactory. Like Bernard Parras and Alfred Knox, who were there, said so. But the pessimism seemed to occur the farther you got away from the front. So what eventually happened was the Jewish and liberal press in Russia then took over. And that's where you get the mythology concerning Russian defeat. The press, not just in the East, but the West as well, exaggerated the alleged Russian defeat against the Japanese and its shortage of ammunition and rifles and everything else. None of that was really true. But because the press was of one mind in reporting this, not having many people on the ground, it's taken as fact. But by late 1916, shortages, which everyone had suffered early on, was just a thing of the past. In fact, Russian mobilization was superior to the German in the early years of the war, according to Niall Ferguson. But the Russian army disintegrated once the Tsar was overthrown in February of 1917. The Bolsheviks had made a deal with the Germans, and they signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk that same year. And then the regular forces of the Tsar became the so-called White Armies and fought the much better funded Bolshevik forces. The Duma, which had been forced upon Russia by the revolution of 1905, did very little. The factions in the Duma could agree on no common action, and so they called a provisional committee, which essentially was a mouthpiece of the Masonic Kerensky government. The Bolsheviks were well-funded, well-armed, well under centralized command, ultimately triumphed. Leon Trotsky was the commander of the Red Army, not because he had any military experience, he did not, but he was a financier of the army, and he was so ruthless and soulless that he was willing to sacrifice untold numbers of non-Jewish males for the sake of his agenda. The liberals in the army were led by General Alexeyev, who had asked the Tsar to abdicate. They tried to use the Bolsheviks tried to use the most vile, hypocritical, patriotic propaganda against the monarchy, claiming that Alexander was German and therefore they really were deliberately throwing the war in German favor. Of course, they knew that this wasn't true. But that was the that was the attempt. So really, the British ruling classes, which were sleazy as you can get, they were petitioned to take Nicholas as refugees, and even after the massive blood that Russia had shed for English causes, he was not released. The pictures that they had scrawled in the room, now remember, there is no Apatiev house. That was owned by the family called Yeltsin. It was a Jewish gold merchant family of ill repute, or so it was said. There were three, the Hebrew letter Lamed. Now, Lamed refers to the heart, and the heart is the king of the body. The remainder of the occult physiology is the Nesham, the brain, Ruach, the heart, and Nefesh, the liver, or the subconscious. The realm of Nefesh is a realm of sort of occult ideology or psychoanalysis. The destruction of the heart is a symbolic destruction of the king or the heart of the nation, its guiding light. The double Lamed is often used in Arabic society to refer to a man being torn to pieces. It also refers to the 12th card of the tarot deck, which is a man hanging by 1 foot from a pole, which is horizontally, which is significant to the occult. one set between two trees on which six branches have been cut. The man's arms are tied and folded in such a way to create this triangle pointing down, while the man's head forming the point or apex of the triangle. So this symbol was used and drawn on the wall of the Ipatiev house. A horizontal line is drawn underneath the letters, which represents passivity. In other words, as the slogan said, they were acting on orders from a higher power. But the hanged man in the tarot deck represents a major turning point in human history, where all beliefs have been turned upside down. The rule of deception. It's a direct rule of aliens. The murder of the king brings a period in their mind of peace and self-actualization, according to occult adepts, and a concept that's well thought out in Freud in his Civilization as Discontent. It also, as you may have noticed, approximates the Star of David, where God is captured and reversed. The hanged man is a reversal of values and the destruction of a state of war. That is to say, the conquest of the realm of God, and this is from the Jewish point of view. God has to die, so the story goes, so that the aliens or the outsiders might live. So the Talmud is absolutely essential, because there, Judaism collectively becomes God and therefore Antichrist. So we translated what these symbols were. And the sacrifice of the king that brings about the destruction of the kingdom. It is, first of all, the notion that orthodoxy, which the Tsar is the head, the earthly head, so to speak, has been overthrown. It means, secondly, that the monarchy is a form of society, not merely a form of state. It's about political power. And there's another translation from the website of the Ipatiev House that says, another version of what I said before, here, through secret forces, the Tsar has been offered sacrifice so that his country may be destroyed. All peoples, that is Goyim, are informed of the event. So Lamed is a powerful word, in letter in the Hebrew alphabet. It initially meant an ox goad, a way to get oxen moving. But it also means to teach and to learn. It's often used as a dialectical negation. And all of these make perfect sense in the destruction of the royal family. But there's even more that suggests, I mean, clearly the occult influences are everywhere here. And one of the better book, I want to say better book, because the English language histories of this are all equally bad. But some are worse than others. Edvard Radzinsky, The Last Tsar, strongly suggests, but doesn't come out and say, the arcane methodology used here. But he refers to the murders of sacrifices twice in his book. I don't know if he did that on purpose or not. And he mentions on page 247, he says something bizarre, almost out of nowhere. In referring to the Tsar, he says, he was a special Taurus, a golden calf, a calf born for sacrifice. Now, the mention of the sacred bull and the calf of Hebrew paganism in the Old Testament is way too coincidental to be just a mere literary flourish. And he says this on page 324 of his very famous book. He says this. There are more hints, however. The name of the operation to murder the Tsar was called chimney sweep. It's telling because a chimney sweep was also the main form of child slavery found in early industrial England. And this is, again, that was what he said. Now I'm speaking here now. And it was actually Michael Hoffman who first taught me about the chimney sweep, abuse of children, and slavery in industrial England. So it refers to the sacrifice of children on the altar of industrialization, wherein the occult, the arcane lore, the realm of Saturn, the god who sacrifices children in the process of severing man's connection with nature. Industrialization is the exoteric realm of Saturn, where machines control nature and separate man from it, and they create a virtual world over and above the natural one. Of course, we're in the very advanced stages of that. It's kind of strange that Yurovsky, who was the main man, brings back the many pieces of stolen silver to the Tsar just before their execution. Now, that's a ritual act. Now, as the letter Lamed suggests, the murder of the Tsar is classic killing of the king ritual, so important to Masonry and modern magic. I've spoken about it on this lecture series many, many times. why return these pieces of silver to the Tsar just before his execution? It really is the process of creating some royal pomp to provide the murder with greater psychological weight. It also comes up again on the borders of Yekaterinburg. Now, this is also the city of the Empress Catherine, the woman who was involved in the murder of Tsar Peter III. A murder just on the eve of liberation, so to speak. One might answer that the whites were trying to rescue the Tsar, and thus it necessitated the murder, which doesn't make any sense because the English language books say the Tsar was unpopular. So what difference did it make? How could he be used to rally around? Why would liberating the Tsar be a threat at all, then? If the whites were fighting for the Duma, how the liberation of the Tsar is anyway relevant to anything here? The liberation ploy was a show, something to elevate the tension, making the ritual, which ultimately has psychological roots, more powerful, magically speaking. As it turns out, the Cheka were involved in faking a series of letters from army officers loyal to the Tsar and sending them to Nicholas. Much later, members of the execution squad admitted that this royalist plot, in which the executioners were obsessed, was something manufactured by the Cheka. It gets even crazier, because the Impaktiev house has one of its basement windows. The window behind where the family was murdered was situated precisely between two trees, a fact pointedly brought out by Radzinski, and precisely necessary to carry out the ritual, at least as the 12th card of the tarot deck mentions. As I've said before, at the time of the overthrow of the Tsar, the world's greatest epidemic was unleashed. About 700,000 Americans were killed between 1917 and 1921. About 4% of the world's population was wiped out. Now, for those who aren't really familiar with the financiers behind the revolution, people don't understand why wealthy capitalists, or really oligarchs, whatever, want to support the Red Forces, which at least in public wanted to nationalize these banks. Well, Eustace Mullins says this in reply. These Americans are the finest temper, chose Lenin to do their dirty work because he had outlined the plan that they wanted in the threatening catastrophe in September 1917. And the first part of that was the nationalization of the banks. Ownership of capital, which is manipulated by the banks, is not lost or changed when the banks are nationalized and fused into one state bank, so that it's possible to reach a state where the state knows whither and how and from where and at what time millions and billions are flowing. Only control for bank operations, providing their immersion to one state bank, will allow, simultaneously, with other measures, which can be easily put into effect, the actual levying of the income tax without concealment of property and income. Mullins says that on page 66. In other words, the communist program had always been in the interest of the bankers to completely standardize the Russian system, which, of course, up until then did not have a central bank. It was important if the massive wealth of the country was to be controlled. The massive economic success of Tsar Alexander III and Nicholas II was really titillating the globe's oligarchy. So, from the book Wall Street and the Russian Revolution, which is Anthony Sutton's work, he says this. Although Jacob Schiff's personal agent, George Keenan, had regularly toured Russia during the latter part of the 19th century, bringing in money and arms for the communist revolutionaries, his grandson said that Schiff had spent $20 million to bring about the Bolshevik Revolution. More concerted aid was called for to support the entire regime. Keenan also aided Schiff in financing the Japanese in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905, and in fact the Japanese decorated Keenan with the Gold War Medal and the Order of the Sacred Treasure. In 1915, the American International Corporation was formed in New York. Its principal goal was the coordination of aid, particularly financial assistance to the Bolsheviks, which had previously been provided by Schiff and other bankers on an informal basis. The new firm was funded by J.P. Morgan, the Rockefellers, and the National City Bank. And he says that on pages 64 and 65. And then the great historian Nesta Webster, she writes in The Surrender of an Empire, "Had the Bolsheviks been, as they represented, a mere gang of revolutionaries out to destroy property, first in Russia and then in every other country, they would naturally have found themselves up against organized resistance by owners of property all over the world, and the Moscow blaze would have rapidly been extinguished. It was only owing to the powerful influences behind them that this minority party was able to seize the reins of power, and having seized them, to retain their hold of them to the present day." But Sutton, almost following to an extent on Webster, he says, "In brief, this is a story of the Bolshevik Revolution and its aftermath, but a story that departs from the usual conceptual straitjacket approach of capitalists versus communists. Our story postulates a partnership between international monopoly capital and international revolutionary socialism for their mutual benefit. The final human cost of this alliance has fallen upon the shoulders of the individual Russian and the individual American. Entrepreneurship has been brought into disrepute, and the world has been propelled toward inefficient socialist planning as a result of these monopoly maneuverings in the world of politics and revolution." So the revolution of 1905 was a prelude to the later revolution and funded by the same people for the same goal: the complete standardization of the Russian state and therefore the complete transparency of Russian financial transactions. Standardization means control. The ultimate capitalist, as well as the ultimate communist gnosis, is a complete concentration of all productive forces under the control of a single unified body. So Lenin, the Schiffs, the Rockefellers, and Warburgs, to this respect, in this extent, had identical interests. Now, I've spoken on this show about the so-called pogroms. They didn't happen. Now, I have articles on this. I have lectures on this. I don't have tons of time to go into them. But this was the justification for the overthrow of the Tsar in the Western press. Really, the simple best argument for, you know, attacking the notion of the pogroms being somehow organized by St. Petersburg is that they all occurred in the far west of the empire and some of the most economically advanced parts of it. The state had absolutely no interest in seeing these extremely strategic cities up in flames. Any analysis of these so-called pogroms show more Christians than Jews having been killed. There were no laws on gun ownership in Tsarist Russia whatsoever, and certainly none that could be enforced. So the Jewish militia in these cities like Odessa, they owned heavy weapons, they owned artillery pieces, they owned 50 caliber machine guns, and were very well armed and had been training in that area. And this is essentially what Justin, again, this is the pogrom czar was almost the name that he was given. And the sources for these so-called atrocities were from the New York Times and the London Times, as well as the Jewish World. The Jewish World newspaper furnished the majority of these tall tales, having sent a reporter to visit areas that had suffered. And although most of the other papers simply repeated what the Jewish World had sent them. And that provoked global outrage. And it was in the United States that this public indignation had reached its height. And the historian Edward Judge, he states in his work in 2012 that the American public was spurred on by reports of the brutal beatings, multiple rapes, dismemberment of corpses, senseless slaughter, painful suffering, and unbearable grief, which was his quote. And really one of the worst parts of all of this was the Russian popular press from 1905. It was overwhelmingly Jewish owned. Jews had more than freedom of movement, throughout the empire, and of course were the wealthiest single element, at least in the western part of the empire. There was full freedom of the press in Russia, most unfortunately, because all these people did is they invented the wildest stories. And the notion of satire and a news article were very much blurred. There was no press censorship even during World War I. And like all the world's newspapers, it was largely Jewish and liberal. And the liberal press, not owned by Jews, really pretty much repeated what the more powerful press agencies throughout the world were saying. And unfortunately, the Jewish world, as well as newspapers in Russia, were taken as true by the Western press with really no criticism. You got to remember, 1910, 1915, 1920. That 10-year period and beyond, the Western world knew almost nothing about Russian history and Russian politics. You had your classic propaganda lines, the murders of women and infants, rape of underage girls. One Jew had his belly ripped open and his insides came out. A Jewish woman had nails driven into her head through her nostrils, on and on and on. This kind of lurid reporting was not even meant to be literally true, but it's what the Jews felt to be experiencing. And of course, far more Christians were killed than Jews. And this is really the most horrible form of muckraking. Solzhenitsyn says this. Moreover, because of their cohesion and solidarity, they, that is the Jews, have, with few exceptions, directed all their efforts not towards the increase of the productive strengths of the state, but primarily towards the exploitation of the poorest classes of the surrounding population. For example, 1905, the Kiev program saw the death toll of a few hundred. 12% were Jews. Generally, the so-called pogroms were started by a very well-armed Jewish revolutionary group attacking the Russian nationalists in any given area. In Odessa, a Black Hundred march was interrupted by a bomb thrown by Jacob Breitman. In 1906, in Chernigov, incitement leaflets were traced to Israel Tamgolsky, Yankel Bruck, and Pinkus Kurigsky, and they called for the murder of all royalists, death to the Tsar, and shutting down all royalist newspapers. And even the Duma, the Russian parliament, in February of 1917, called for the death of all royalists. These so-called pogroms were instigated by Jewish militias and did far more damage to the Christian population. But at any time a Jew had been killed in retaliation or during the fighting, it was reported as a pogrom. William Randolph Hearst said, "We accuse the Russian government of bearing the responsibility for the Chisinau slaughter. We declare that the Holocaust is steeped in blood. It is on Nicholas's door that lie these killings and violence. May the God of justice come into this." And these citations are from the work from Platonov. And he concludes by saying, "Sweeping this hotbed of hate from the earth as a plague." Ironically, the plague that was very soon to envelop the world. So William Randolph Hearst called for the absolute slaughter of Russian royalists and the Russian state. Now, what really frightened the left, globally speaking, I'm referring to whether it be liberals or communists or anyone that we generally refer to as being on the left of the spectrum. So the Russian Empire was growing in terms of demographics by about 2.4 million people a year. And this really is the cause of British worry, because demographics are power. The Russian Empire under Tsar Nicholas and his father, Alexander III, had almost no debt, at least no long-term debt, and the budget was in surplus every year. And the reason for this is that about 60% of the budget was under the direct supervision of the Tsar, not the parliament. And as has been said many other places, the tax burden of the Russian subject was 9 times lighter than that of liberal England and 4 times lighter than that of France. Of course, the average worker in Russia had absolutely nothing to complain about. So they needed to create issues that didn't exist. Now, I also need to mention Rasputin. I've mentioned on this show the Kerensky emergency inquest that he, right after the throw of overthrow of Tsar Nicholas, had engaged in hoping to justify the revolution and find all kinds of corruption. And this is what the EIC stated in 19 July of 1917. And this is, by the way, from his enemies. This is V.I. Rudnev, the chief researcher for the emergency committee. This testimonial delivered to Mikhail Lebyukov certifies that not a single indication of Gregory Rasputin's political activity was disclosed by the High Commission of Inquiry. The inquiry into the influence of Rasputin on the imperial family was intensive, but it was definitively established that the influence had its source only in the profound religious sentiment of their majesties. The only favor Rasputin accepted was a rental of his lodging, paid by the personal chancellery of his majesty. It also accepted presents made at the hands of the imperial family, like shirts and things like that. Rasputin had no connection with any foreign authorities. But all pamphlets and newspaper articles on the subject of Rasputin, his influence, and other rumors and gossip were fabricated by the powerful enemies of the emperor. This statement is given under the signature and seal of the Attorney General of the High Commission. Now, this provisional government, after the formal abdication of the Tsar in 1917, or what we think was that, had full access to all the private papers of Tsar Nicholas, the Duma, all government ministries. Never has there been an exhaustive commission into the form, behavior, structure, functioning of the royal government has ever even been attempted. Given the full access to all the records of the commission, most of which, by the way, was destroyed by the Bolsheviks for obvious reasons, they found not only no moral problems with Rasputin, but also that the imperial government maintained the highest standards of personal dignity while holding office. And all of this from the sworn enemies of the imperial state. Another quote from this is, "It turns out that the supreme power in the last months of the old regime itself gradually delegated parts of their sovereign rights in the hands of ministers or senior officials. All of us, dear comrades, lived under the old regime, and we all know what was being done. We all think something terrible is happening in the police department. You know, in all fairness, it should be, not as it is in the depraved imagination of the Russian people, but what is really there. In front of me is a document which is a Magna Carta of the police department as to its lawlessness. The document is called the Instruction on the Organization and Conduct of the Gendarme and Investigative Offices. Entire generations who gave themselves to the police had a hand in the creation of this manual, and all of them gradually perfected the system." In other words, this man could find absolutely nothing in the police department worthy of any kind of legal prosecution. It does say something about the provisional government, that they were interested in the truth rather than violence for its own sake. And it also means that Kerensky didn't trust the ramblings of the media, as slanderous as it was. But this commission is kept out of the history textbooks for a reason. And because these men went through every paper relevant to this, spoke of Rasputin as having very little influence, of not ever even visiting the palace. He just wanted to go home. Rasputin was something that was invented by the press because they couldn't attack the Tsar directly. Rasputin never took any credit for his services. He never sought any kind of favors as a result of it. He was vehemently opposed to any kind of mesmerism or hypnosis. He was not even aware of these techniques. Rasputin would routinely just leave the company of the royal family, just to leave to go back to Siberia. This is where his family was. They begged him to return. Obviously, he wasn't power mad. He was just trying to get home. But eyewitnesses say that there's no evidence that Rasputin had any political agenda whatsoever. He respected the reigning royal family, but there's no evidence he was even royalist. Rasputin didn't have much of a political agenda. He was far from a perennial presence there. And it didn't take him long to make enemies for no other reason than the press was saying that he is this leader. You see this even today, where Alexander Dugin is said to be the confidant of Vladimir Putin. Dugin has never had any role as an advisor to him. Absolutely none. He has no formal government position. And chances are that Dugin probably writes over the head of anyone in government. He has no influence over the state. Now, he has influence over the society as a whole, and therefore from that indirect source may have it. But without anyone knowing anything about the society, they could pretty much say anything. So, you know, part of the problem, part of the reason that people hated Rasputin was that he was keeping the Tsarevich alive. That he was clearly, you know, he knew quite a bit about medications. He was a man who was bringing some of the traditional medicine of Siberia to the Tsarevich himself. I mean, this is actually a very practical matter. He had no political power. He had no political agenda. He didn't even want to be there. And this is just how it goes. Contrary to everything that you've heard, he had no desire for power. He was not a drinker. He didn't have an out-of-control libido. But needing a character to be invented to attack the Tsar is what created this mythology about Rasputin. The High Commission of Inquiry had completely debunked the police reports that made Rasputin out to be this drunk rapist. It didn't exist. These are largely rumor. And the High Commission of Kerensky said that there's simply no truth to them. And, of course, there was a cabal who didn't like the idea that Rasputin was keeping the Tsarevich alive. And, by the way, very much opposed to Russian entry into World War I, but the only political position he had that anyone knows about. And then Prince Yusupov, and actually Felix Yusupov was, tried to bribe Rasputin to get him to say things, and he was refused. In fact, Yusupov had been so, Yusupov, I should say, had to leave for England because he was simply embarrassed. And Yusupov began to circulate stories about Rasputin in the English press in his exile in London. That's where, starting about 1909 forward, Prince Yusupov was giving interviews with the British press where he was saying, I'm an eyewitness to this kind of horrible stuff that he was doing. And none of it was true. None of it is true. Remember, most of the nobility, the upper nobility in St. Petersburg had long since been converted to liberalism. Many of them resented the tradition and the traditionalism of the emperor. And certainly the presence of an uneducated hick at court. Now, Rasputin was not uneducated. He had strong peasant roots. But he only showed up when the Tsarevich needed him, and at no other time. The nobility had long since, you know, threw their weight behind liberal reform, and slowly through the Masonic lodges, which even the mainstream press in America says were very, very powerful in Russia, mobilized this nobility to the point where the emperor was surrounded by turncoats and traitors. Each one of these families, viewing themselves as the future president of a Republican Russia, or even as the next emperor, he could trust absolutely nobody. There was a report that Rasputin was a member of the Kulisti sect, and there's absolutely no evidence to that either. Yusupov in London concocted many stories, and, you know, to have a dark figure like Rasputin looming over the palace, making decisions, that was something that the Western press just ate up. They loved it. Tsar Nicholas was too popular in Russia itself to really attack him in the press. It was not a good idea, politically speaking. And yet, creating Rasputin was a way to indirectly attack the monarchy. Police officer N. Prilina stated his report January 4th, 1910, that Rasputin was never drunk. He wasn't a drinker at all. There was a theory that some policemen had developed that Rasputin was brought in to heal the schism of the old belief And you have many who are saying that, and say even today, and it's a very popular theory in Russia now, is that the murder of Rasputin was the first stage in the revolutionary coup. His murder was the first shot in the revolution. Rasputin was a means to desacralize the monarchy without actually attacking it directly. The Archbishop Ambrose, Shurov, in a royalist conference in 2002, said that Rasputin suffered many attacks from the enemies of Russia. The press created hatred of the crown so as to cast a shadow on the royal family. In other words, they were using this man. You had many saintly elders like Jerome or Kirill Pavlov, Nicholas Sugurano, who were there at the time and who, you know, really venerated Rasputin for his righteous behavior. Now, I think the very first attack of any depth on Rasputin came in 1910, and it came from the Supreme Council of Russian Freemasonry and its two organs, which were Slovo and the Russian Word. And so the Masons, Malakov, Gessen, Venever, and the twin brothers, Princes Dolgorki, were the owners and backers of this journal. And B.I. Nicholas's book on Russian Freemasonry strongly implicates the Supreme Council as a major player in the fight against the crown, using Rasputin as a foil. But it was M.V. Rodzianko, who was the chair of the Duma, who fully admitted that it was a Masonic Congress in Brussels that created the first attacks on Rasputin. You had a Russian Baptist, J.S. Prokhanov, stating that with Rasputin gone, the Reformation can be brought to Russia, meaning the Protestant Reformation. It's not too far of a stretch here to consider the causes of the fall of the Tsardom, and by that, the end of the era of the Christian state inaugurated by St. Constantine the Great in the 4th century, of which the Russian Tsar was a direct descendant. And you can summarize this, you know, the rise of Rasputin, World War I, the Orthodox remnant become very, very small. The defensive in this church was very scattered. The leadership of the church was Republican. Only a handful of bishops could be called committed monarchists. So what do we have? And anyone who wants to study the murder of Tsar Nicholas and the family and this gradual desacralization of the royal house in general has to deal with the consequences of what occurred here. The provisional government was, you know, they had a very limited role in Russian history. They weren't allowed around for very long. They had no real ideology other than Freemasonry itself. And, you know, the Bolsheviks being far, you know, far, far better funded. Because the Allies had given up on the Kerensky government, the White Armies didn't get a penny from them. And I've spoken about this at length elsewhere. Because the Whites, who were not royalists, in fact, most of them were anti-royalist, and also not aristocratic either. The white high command was overwhelmingly from the people, contrary to red propaganda. That's not the case in the Red Army, by the way. But what happened in Russia after the murder of the Tsar pretty much is all you need to know to justify the existence of the monarchy. Whether it be the Republican system from 1990 to roughly 2004, the Bolshevik Revolution itself, the Stalin's purges, the invasion of the Soviet Union by Germany, whatever, you know, whichever tack that you take, we'll see the utter destruction and evil that came from this. Antichrist was able to rule openly. The Soviets were one manifestation of Antichrist. You know, Antichrist is a collective entity. It's essentially Adam Kadmon, the new man of the Kabbalah. It's not one man. It's Adam Kadmon, who is you know, a metaphorical individual. It's the Jewish elite working as one man. No one, I mean, they would have to be so crude to have one man taking over as Antichrist, because he would automatically be seen as that. So it has to be more, it has to be better disguised. And that disguise is that you're talking about an institution who functions as one man. So whether you talk about the Jewish elite or Adam Kadmon or the revolutionary new man that these people were trying to create, you're still talking about an individual, just a very subtle one. So you're not talking about a single world ruler. No such world ruler could ever be accepted. And you don't have to be Christian to realize that that's, you know, the notion of having one man with absolute power over the world is laughable. The biases for liberal democracy are so overwhelming that this simply can't happen. Plus the simple fact is that no one man can rule the planet. It would have to be a coalition. But it has to be a coalition of an entity, the Jewish elite, that function as one man. And as time has gone on, the very crude violence of the Soviet Union gave way to a far more subtle manipulation of images that postmodernity has developed into in the West, where the definitions of words, the way that people think, the use of psychology to probe every weakness of humanity, mentally speaking, is being used to completely shift not just what people think about, but how they think in the first place. The redefinition of words, the rewriting of history. I mean, we're at a stage now in America, 2018, where all right-wing opinion is de facto illegal. Now, you have the First Amendment, but of course that's just a formality. The government is not the issue here. Private capital is. Private capital is protected by the First Amendment. It's not subject to it, even though private capital has far more power than the state does. To be on the, to be a nationalist in America is to be fired from every job you can have, and we all know people in this boat, to be forbidden an education, even forbidden to have a family, have any kind of a normal social life in any way, shape, matter, or form. In other words, it's illegal in all but the formal. Now, there is no law banning this, although with hate speech, of course, and, as Edgar Steele once said, once they redefine speech as a form of violence, it will then be de jure illegal, not just de facto. And if something happens to us, such that we're thrown in prison, or as poor Edgar Steele himself, murdered, who's going to come to our defense? No one in the press cares. And it's really not that hard to draw a line from the murder of Tsar Nicholas to this present situation. The Third Reich was a last-ditch attempt to crush the Soviet Union and bring about nationalism as the counter-revolutionary ideology. And that failed, as we all know. Just like Tsar Nicholas, Hitler was surrounded by traitors and agents, the least of which was Erich Koch in Ukraine. Russia was the key to victory for Germany. Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia saw Hitler as the foundation of social justice in the Industrial Age. And the Metropolitan Anastasi had called for a Russian Hitler to take over in Russia after Stalin. One of the most significant elements to all of this is the fact that the arcana, the occult, is very explicitly stated in the propaganda and the graffiti on the wall of that house to be absolutely essential. This is primarily a spiritual development. The monarchy in Russia was a religious figure. There was no secular state. I mean, there was de facto, but that's not the understanding of symphony. I have a separate lecture on that. I've been through very briefly all the symbols found scrawled on the wall. And that concept, by the way, of killing the king for the sake of destroying society, that's a formula. That's been found in several other places. In 1942 in Palestine, a group of Zionists had assassinated a British agent there. And that was, just without any reference to the king, scroll on the wall there as well. The reference to hidden forces, the destruction of society, essentially bringing about revolution. And when they use the phrase Balthazar, they spelled the last four letters with T-S-A-R, which, of course, is a deliberate play on words. And the Hanging Man tarot card is about the transvaluation of all values. This is why the killing of the king is the essential ritual in modernity and postmodernity. And the reason it's been successful is that the Jews are the center. And the Jews are so ethnically cohesive that their lack of numbers don't matter. What they are really examples of nationalism, although in this case for a perverted reason. The symbols are absolutely saturated in the murder of the Tsar. This was explicitly a demonic ritual. It was primarily a religious act. Therefore, you know, we're talking about the absolute proof of the nature of the occult arcana and how it views monarchy, which is why monarchy is the really only legitimate form of government from the Orthodox point of view, coming from Samuel and David in the Old Testament. The era of the judges was very brief. And the only problem that the prophet Samuel had with the Israelites demanding a monarch was really that they wanted to be a monarch like everyone else. So it was the everyone else part, not the monarchy part, that was condemned. Monarchy is the only form of legitimate Orthodox government. And I don't necessarily even mean that you have to have a long-standing royal house. Because in Serbia, the royal house, whether it be Obrenović or Karađorđević, is only early 19th century and doesn't go beyond that. Someone like Putin or General Franco or someone like that is also acceptable from the royalist point of view. It doesn't have to be a literal hereditary sacred house. That might be nice, but it's not absolutely necessary. Even in Byzantium or the old Roman Empire before that, you really didn't have any law concerning succession. But how the Jewish elite viewed monarchy as the entity most inimical to their interests, and how liberal republicanism is essentially their ideology. You know, the letter Lamed in the Hebrew alphabet actually referred to an ox goad. This is how to force the oxen, which is essentially another word for goyim, into action. It's the simple fact that the goyim are so ignorant that only, you know, this ritual can spur them into action, that there's nothing worth fighting for. The abulia, or the lethargy that most people have today, but a lethargy that's born of the fact that there is no truth, and therefore there's nothing to be excited about. And the symbols all form a really cohesive whole. And even when you have mainline writers like Radzinski, talking of Tsar Nicholas as a golden calf, a calf born for sacrifice. This is really, you know, there's simply no denying that these forces exist, and the explicit mention of the sacrifice of the monarch to demons in exchange for power. They're not fooling around here. This is exactly what they said. This is exactly what they meant. And when you have mainline sources having to admit that, you're at a different stage in history. So the Kali Yuga era, the era of iron in the Roman understanding, began with the murder of Tsar Nicholas. Rome had finally fallen, albeit temporarily. Finally, it shows that Russia is the center of all things, that no other nation has this level of significance, that the last Christian empire was that of Russia up until late 1917. And what happens to Russia happens to the world. And Russian ethnicity is a religious matter, not necessarily an ethnic matter. And so, you know, I'm far more Russian than Lenin could ever be. Keep in mind, too, that, you know, Jews today, you know, make up a minuscule percentage of the Russian population. Many of them have left the country starting in the 1970s. But this is the core of what we're talking about here. There's an explicit mention of demons and the humiliation, the verbal and physical assault on the girls. And this is all ritualistic and explicitly stated as such in the formula. So here we are, 100 years almost exactly from the start of the end, so to speak. These are the end times. If it isn't, then everything in scriptures is false. There could be no question about it. This is the new era. This is the era of iron, and very explicitly, given the symbols that were used at the Apotheos house. And even that was a matter of deception, because there's no Apotheos who owned that place. Because of this, we have started the era of iron. And the Orthodox Church has now been reduced to a handful. And one thing that you want to take away from all of this is how few of the Russian bishops at the time were willing to support Nicholas. This is one of the reasons that the Russian Orthodox Church outside Russia had stated that, you know, Russia itself is responsible for the murder of Tsar Nicholas. Because the church overwhelmingly had backed the provisional government. Remember, it was a provisional government that called the Synod of 1918 that elected Tikhon. The monarch didn't do that. And he would be the only authority that had that capacity. The overwhelming majority of the high clergy was opposed to Tsar Nicholas and was quite happy to see him go. And a handful, like St. Macarius, for example, of Moscow, Metropolitan, were purged from the church. And so you see the rot that had entered into this society through the Masonic city of St. Petersburg. So this is what you take away from all of this, the destruction, the irrationality. But everything that we despise today comes from this 100-year-old event. The murder of the Tsar, the killing of the king, was a sacrifice which made all the evil that have come afterwards possible. Anyway, I've gone over my time. The miracles that have been attributed to Tsar Nicholas is overwhelming. There can be no doubt that he's interceding on a regular basis for his people here, for his Orthodox people here. And there is only one political system, and that is monarchy of one form or another. And the murder of Tsar Nicholas shows just how essential monarchy is in restraining Antichrist in these last times. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.